How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 113, The Amazon in Times of War, an interview with Marcos Colón. The Amazon rainforest is a place which looms large in our collective imaginations. It serves as perhaps the most emblematic natural wilderness in the world. And of course, this means that damage done to the natural world there also looms larger than probably anywhere else in discussions about ecological crisis. I spent a few weeks there in 2022, and my time visiting was one of the most intriguing trips I've ever been on. I spent some time in remote communities and travelled for 4 days on an open-air boat. This gave me a sense of just how vast this ecosystem is. It was an incredible experience, even if not always a comfortable one. But even in that short time, I couldn't help but pick up that the Amazon had its fair share of problems. We haven't covered the region that much on the podcast so far. You might remember, however, that in those earliest episodes on the pre-Columbian Americas, the new research has changed our understanding of the place. LIDAR imagery is showing that it was once home to large populations living in cities, and modifying their natural surroundings through things like soil enrichment. Well, today, thanks to Marcos Colón, we're going to learn more about the Amazon's more recent history and the challenges which it faces right now. Marcos is a professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, part of the Arizona State University. But he's also a filmmaker and the founder and editor of Amazonia Latitude, a website which provides news, opinions, essays, photography, and podcasts about the region. A collection of his essays have recently been published as a book named The Amazon in Times of War. As you can probably guess by the title, the subject matter, unfortunately, requires dealing with challenges and threats to the ecosystem, wildlife, and people who call the Amazon home. Through these essays, he charts the recent history of the region, combining statistics, personal anecdotes, and analysis of events. So here's Marcos to tell us more. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast, Marcos.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Thank you, Max, for having me and to talk with your audience and your folks there listening to us.
So although the Amazon spans quite a few countries, the bulk of it's in Brazil. And so the politics of that country affect the region, and those politics have been particularly turbulent recently. In the last 20 years, there's been a number of administrations, from Lula to Rousseff to Temer, Bolsonaro, and now back to Lula again. So to provide some background to the situation, what does the recent history of government policy towards the Amazon look like?
Well, that's a good question, Max. And I think it's a very important for us to dive into in order to understand this context and this government policies that has been affected the region and its people, of course, the humans and all humans as well. So I would say that the Amazon fate is deeply tied to the Brazil political shift, where administrations, you know, alternate all the time between the left and the right wings, ideologies. And this kind of, for me, the rhetoric of preservation sometimes versus productivity or differs a lot, you know. But what really underlines here is an approach to the region which always has been seen historically as exporter of primary goods. And this idea remains a constant pattern, regardless of who is in power, you know, if it's left or right. I mean, doesn't matter. And this is something that we need to pay attention to if you, when you think ahead to the future, I would say that, whatever the future has in store for the Amazon. But over the past two decades, as you frame, Brazil has a cycle through the administration since Lula, you know, then Dilma Rousseff, Michel Temer, Jair Bolsonaro. And now, as you know, in the book, I address the Lula for the third time as president. So these transitions reflect differences, or I also can say intensities, because the problem that we have, Max, is that the intensity of destruction may be soft in one government and maybe could be higher in another government, but the destruction is still there. So if you have left-wing governments as Lula or Dilma Rousseff, of course, you know, publicly, they emphasize preservation, indigenous land demarcations, and the protection of traditions communities, right? However, these efforts often coexist with large-scale infrastructure projects like hydraulic dams and roads. Let's, for instance, think about Belo Monte Dam, which was built and approved during Lula presidency, which is also catered to export-oriented industries. And so the point that I was trying to say here is that right-wing government like Temer or Bolsonaro favor occupation strategies that align with the capitalist logic, encouraging agribusiness, mining, logging, and often, you know, they don't care about environment safeguards. So that is clear why this intensity, as I mentioned before, of exploitation varies. The overreach framework remains centered on the Amazon roles as a supplier of raw materials for global markets. And thinking about what's going to happen after January 20th, when Donald Trump assumed the presidency of the United States, where he's going to empower those narratives. These left-wing administrations may temper the extractivism approach with more protective policies, but they do not fundamentally diverge from the economic power championed by the right-wing counterparts. And that is the claim that we have been saying, that Lula has an opportunity to reframe, to recalibrate these dynamics right now, going against the agenda that Trump, Donald Trump, will, you know, try to set, environmental agenda, I mean here. So no matter which government has been put in place, the weak oversight, you know, structural challenges, they have this continuity that has profound effect, not only the agencies that has been in the Amazon, like IBAMA, FUNAI, the ECMBio, but those agencies under right-wing administration, you know, there have been severe boycotts, policy restrictions, you know, enabling illegal deforestation, mining, encroachment on indigenous territory. There is so many aggressive, you know, that undermine those institutions, the role that they try to do. And they have been failed. The government has been failed in protect the indigenous communities, protect those territories. I mean, for instance, today, you still have in the Yanomami land around 12, 15,000 miners there. Think about that. Why the government has not been capable to prevent that, to protect the indigenous land? So on the other hand, as you see this, the left wing, even though they have a less aggressive, but they often fail to restructure their withstand political shifty oscillation, continue to perpetuating this region in a fragile state of protection that, for me, it's just, I'm flabbergasted continuously, because we have the opportunity. We have Marina Silva, who has been a stronghold, a voice that has been fight even right now against the possibility to get petroleum in the Amazon. in the region of Amapá, in that region, the border between, you know, Venezuela, the Guianas over there. But there is a showdown between if you should do, if you should not do. And then there is this new grammar, I would say. Now, in the past, they used to talk about exploitation. Now they use bioeconomy. This is just a new grammatic shifting in words that it doesn't change much. It's the same. So what I'm trying to say here is that the lack of continuity and vision for the Amazon, what does it do? It's exacerbated, I would say, by these alternating political priorities, which try to ensure that progress remains elusive there. But environmental policy and preservation efforts are frequently dismantled by successive administration creating this sandcastles effect where short-term gains collapse under opposition agenda. All this on and off, this cycle underscore the absence of long-term structured investment in sustainable models that balance preservation with the local kind of necessities and for protection. In other words, over this past two decades, Brazil really has been failed. So this continuity, despite variation in intensity, weakened oversight agencies, undermines a preservation effort that leaves the Amazon vulnerable to a drastic policies that prioritize short-term goals over structural sustainable solutions. So the result in this region is a trapped in a cycle of exploitation continuously, where environmental and social protections are repeatedly dismantled. And doesn't matter if it's a short or long-term investment. And unless we have the disposition of some radical shift in the agenda that we have currently in course in Brazil to change, I see that continues in the region.
So into this political situation, you then, of course, had a few years ago the pandemic, which caused widespread disruption all around the world. There was a time, I remember, where Manaus was perhaps the most badly affected place in the world in terms of case numbers and death numbers. But in your book, you point out that, you know, the effects were much bigger than the simple medical effects as well. So what impact did the pandemic have on the Amazon as a whole, both in those direct terms and also in terms of policy?
I think the impact was huge. And I think the impact is still echoing today in a different way, not in a pandemic, but a different kind of pandemic. I would say the burn season, I see that as well as a pandemic. Because, of course, we talk about the impact of the COVID-19, but a continuation of this has been what the droughts and what the burning season has caused into the region. But I would say that, I mean, you can just divide your question maybe 3 points, but I think my criticism has been all along about the system itself that is in place in the region. And as we talk about the government policies, they never think in a long-term structure or infrastructure. Because of this on and off government change, shifts, right and left, whatever that happens. So for the Amazon, nothing changed. It's still the same. So the COVID-19 pandemic profoundly affected the Amazon. What it did was expose critical vulnerabilities in public health system and governance in the region. So Manaus, I remember, I mean, I'm working in a project about this particular time since the first case of COVID in Manaus, the amount of indigenous communities that was affecting the region, because we have a lot of urban, you know, local indigenous in the Manaus area. But also, as you saw, how that, you know, the lack of oxygen became a worldwide, you know, kind of headlines. So Manaus, as you know, for your listeners, is the capital of the Amazon state and was dramatically impacted by those issues of COVID, which highlight a systemic issue across the region. Because that is an important thing, because what you saw there was a systemic problem. The problem is the centralization of healthcare. So I wrote about this during the COVID time. I did a strong criticism along with my friend, Eric Jennings, which is a medical doctor, neurosurgeon in Santarém. And we wrote together about how the centralization of healthcare in Brazil, particularly in the Amazon, are heavily centralizing urban centers like Manaus, or in his case, Santarém, but you can go to Belém and many other cities. So this model proved disastrous during the pandemic. So what we advocate in that particular article is that how about take care of the people in their communities instead of them have to dislocate from their communities to these urban centers, for instance. What is the problem? The problem is the difficulty of reaching these urban hubs for treatment, which turn the cities into COVID hotbeds, overwhelming already fragile infrastructure that those places have. That's what happened in Manaus. So the oxygen shortages and high mortality was because of that, because they didn't have no infrastructure. Manaus experienced one of the most publicized health crises, I would say, in that particular time, with death tolls extremely high. Why is that? Go back to your first question, because there is the governance and policies for the region has never considered them seriously. So the Brazilian government at all levels react sluggishly to the pandemic. And then you have to talk about Bolsonaro, of course, because as the federal government under his presidency, he minimized the severity of COVID, delayed vaccination, and other measures. Brazil has the second largest number of deaths in COVID in the world. So the denial, the denialism reflect this broader systemic issue in the public health policy. And what we see there, what we see in this, during the COVID time, we had a lot of money that was sent off to those areas in the Amazon. How many bedrooms were built during that time? How many of them were kept or preserved for today's situation in the Amazon? The answer is none. So all the supply that was spent in that particular time, so for instance, resources that were eventually mobilized during that particular time, such as respirators, hospital beds, or even field hospitals, you know, these efforts were totally under-coordinated and was very temporary, right? But billions of Brazilian reais were spent on measures that left no last infrastructure or improvements in the healthcare system in the Amazon. When you think about this, it makes you angry, because the issues that you see in the Amazons today related to the burn season with respiratory disease that people are facing today is equal to the pandemic atrocities that were experienced in that particular time. But people don't see it in the same way, in the same fashion. For me, this is just, it's bizarre. I mean, and then you have the environmental and public health parallels. What you see is the environmental is being dismantled, suffered, but the public health is in the same level. And a similar situation, you know, even more complicated for future generation, which is going to be experience more disease, respiratory disease, because just last week, Santarém has one of the most contaminated air in the whole world. So the Amazon is now experiencing some of the worst air quality globally. When you think about China, you think about São Paulo, think all of this big city with worse air quality globally. And when you have the image, pristine image about the Amazon, you think, wow, Amazon, you can have the best fresh air, right? No, what you see is the contrary. A lot of people get with respiratory illness, overburdening, you know, local hospital again, which don't have infrastructure sometimes to receive them. So there is no structure in place by the government, and they fail over and over and over again to implement structured measures to address either the environmental crisis and the public health consequences. There is a lacking of long-term planning for no matter which government we have, left or right. So what you have here actually is it's a demand for a call for attention, because some investment was done during COVID in response to that. But what has been done now with the fires, with the drought? It's just always done damage control instead of sustainable preventive measures in the long term. So I think that what the pandemic underscores is the need for structural investment in health and environmental governance. Without long-term planning, Max, the region remains vulnerable to recurring crises. So this is the paradigm shift that is required to focus on sustainable health infrastructure, proactive environmental policies, and better education to prepare to prevent calamities as we see during COVID. And we are about to see now with this all this burn season, all these respiratory problems that people start going to start to face. And particularly in Manaus, the situation is still, for me, shocking. If you go neighbor states like Pará, for example, they took some proactive measures to combat pandemic in that particular time with some research institution to increase some kind of testing capacity. But this is just like one example between two states, Amazonas state and Pará state. They have some kind of contrast there. But I feel that in the long term, I mean, what we see is that in 2023, 2024, for instance, the Amazon faces, you know, the dual threat, I would say. The dual threats of deforestation and fires along historical drought. So what we have seen the Amazon in the last few months, the Amazon lost 8% of her water reserve, according to a recent study. I mean, what we're going to see, if you do not look to the Amazon with a serious consideration, what these historical droughts, these threats of deforestation alongside the public health, the scenario underscore the inextricable link between public health and environmental crisis to a degree that maybe we haven't seen yet. My feeling when I speak about this is just because always when you talk about the Amazon, seems like you were talking about some situations very bad, right? But it is bad. And the loss of entire populations in the Amazon threatens the traditional knowledge which they hold for the forest preservation. It demands our attention, the government attention, to look to these issues and try to learn from those experiences that we had during COVID, which kind of experience we bring for today, 2024, from COVID that we help us to move forward and in a better way to assist the Quilombolas, Caboclos, indigenous communities, indigenous peoples, and everyone that lives in those hubs. So I think we are in a crossroads here, which demands attention, urgent attention from authorities and for the local as well, because they have been actually the ones that has been most impacted by.
I didn't know that fact about the air quality. That's quite incredible. It's like you said, it's completely the opposite of what most people would imagine about the air quality compared to cities. At one point in the book, you said that colonialism did not end with Brazilian independence. So what continuations from the colonial era can we see manifesting themselves today in the Amazon?
I think since the colonial era, Max, the Amazon has been viewed as a resource of storehouse for the metropolis to exploit at will. I mean, they don't have no restriction. You can take everything in, but the same situations is happening today. When I did my film, Beyond Fordlandia, we focus a lot on the exporting of soybean and how they, for instance, they don't pay any taxes. But many products or minerals from the Amazon, they don't pay tax. There is a law in Brazil, Candi law, that prevents them to be taxed, which is a shame. From their time to today, the region continues to be seen primarily as a space to be developed rather than a strategic and vital environmental area requiring protection. How can we call this any other name beyond colonialism? There is a very important thinker in Brazil called Nego Bispo. He passed away, I think, last year. And he was one of the most important thinkers and from the state of Piauí who tried to kind of change the language, the colonialism, and try to use the language of coloniality in order to bring attention to the processes that implies. For instance, he used to use the word, like, we talk about development. And he said, why we don't talk about involvement, implication? He was just using the same words of colonialism strategy in order to re-signify them and try to call attention. I think it was super clever. Unfortunately, he passed away. He left, I think, a book or two, but it was a tragedy and a loss for all of us. My point is that the statement that colonialism did end with Brazilian independence, I think, is vividly illustrated in the Amazon through the enduring patterns of coloniality that shape knowledge, power, and the relationship with nature. So the Amazon reader continues to be perceived and treated through colonial frameworks, where its values is defined by external economic and political interests. You know, doesn't matter. Often this is at the expense of its indigenous peoples and ecosystem. So historically, the Amazon has been imagined and represented as a void. When you have a place that represents as a void or a resources frontier before states and capitalism expansion, erasing the voices, the local voice and experience of its inhabitants, it's something normal. Because if you can kill someone that you do not see, you do not miss, right? Doesn't matter. Doesn't affect you. That's the colonial practice. And this can go on in many ways, Max. But I think we have a coloniality multiply in many ways, the Eurocentric perspective. They continue to be in place, marginalized Amazonian ways of knowing and being related to indigenous epistemology because they are invisible. They are not being, they're not seen. And if you do not see something, doesn't matter if you kill them, you exterminate them because the mindset instrumentalizes nature. So they view nature as a hindrance, obstacles, or raw material to be dominated in stark contrast to the indigenous perception of nature as an integral to life in itself. I think the colonial critics, Nego Bispo, for instance, was trying to do with his use of words, of colonial words, try to challenge this hegemonic framework, but emphasizing the importance of repositioning the narratives about the Amazon to include the indigenous voice, their resistance, and all the struggles of Quilombolas, Black communities. Those are minorities most affected. So resistance to these colonial processes has been consistent and profound, demonstrating in so many ways, but the indigenous communities are only seeing, they don't see as producers of knowledge. They don't see that they can provide any ways of out of that trap. As I was saying to you before, we're talking about indigenous community who lives in this area. If you look to Brazil, you have documenting that for 12,000 years, we have people living in Alenquer, the area there. Or if you go to Colombia, 19,000 years. If you live in a place for 13 or 19,000 years, you must have produced knowledge, right? You need to learn hunting, to make a house, to eat, to find food. You develop an encyclopedia, a dictionary of knowledge for you to survive in that environment. I mean, I have a friend that passed away, Carlos Porto Gonçalves, and he used to say, people want the Brazilian flavors, but they don't want their knowledge. And I like that because people, they wanted their flavors. They wanted to açaí, cupuaçu. But the knowledge from cupuaçu and açaí came from the indigenous. I think, as I said, I mean, coloniality in the Amazon, it's manifest in various interconnected forms. As we have in, you know, this famous essay about coloniality of power, but then you have the coloniality of knowledge as well, coloniality of being or coloniality of nature. But just to break down, coloniality of knowledge highlights this Eurocentric epistemology, but coloniality of being emphasizes how indigenous peoples and other marginalized groups has been dehumanized. Then you have the coloniality of nature, which underscore how colonial logic instrumentalized the environment separate humanity from natural world. So this nature and culture division that we know that for quite some time. Just to finish up here, this is fascinating because exploring epistemic inequality and how it shaped our understanding of the Amazon and its people, it's important because the question is not just about recognize this inequality, but about reposition them. Now, the Amazon is a vast biodiversity and deep cultural importance for not only for us Brazilians, but for the world. It's important, it's central to rethink these knowledge frameworks with a different kind of perspective. I think one of the most consequential implication of the coloniality and the colonialism in the region that we try to do is to question how we recognize and address the unequal position of knowledge, especially regarding to the indigenous communities, the indigenous peoples. I think our effort is offer and to reflect on how the forest and its biodiversity have been shaped by indigenous peoples' knowledge over millennia, as I said, contrast with this idea, with this modernity focus on exploitation destruction. The Amazon, Max, it's not merely a resource. It's a product of human environmental interaction that has developed through indigenous practice over millennia. So we're talking about a region, Max, that has been exist for millennia, and interaction and contact with locals, with human environment interaction between the forest and them. So these practices often dismissed as local or, you know, or regional, whatever you can call, I mean, are central to understand ecological balance and sustainability. I would say through the colonial thought, it's about amplifying this marginalized perspective. Listen to the people, Max, who have been fighting for their land and their wisdom for centuries. And it's our mission to allow their knowledge to guide our global thinking and practice.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If newcomers to the Amazon have long often seen it as, like you said, a storehouse, a place where resources can be taken from, that's one way the region has been visualized. One of the essays in your book looks at some of the other historic and contemporary ways in which people have viewed the Amazon and how it's occupied collective imagination. And it talks about the tensions between these different imaginations and between them and reality. A couple of the phrases you use were green hell and dubious paradise, which were both written by people about the Amazon. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about how it's been seen over the years.
Yeah, I often try to get away of these tropes, green hell, paradise, the Amazon is the lung of the world, you know, all these kind of tropes that are erroneous and sometimes has some biological perspective or even geographic, when you call a void place. All these tropes create imagination about the region or imagine the region in a way that has been always been exoticized. And this vision specifically of paradise and hell is a pattern that persists today. Recently, I wrote a piece called Green Less Hell. It's Inferno Sem Verde. The burn season, the fire was so strong that the Amazon actually became a hell. And that piece was basically on that note because due to the amount of burning, you know, Alberto Rangel, which was a writer from 1927, wrote this book called Green Hell. He didn't imagine the region as we see today. And I think those tropes, they helped us to create this image of the region, which is perpetuating a wrong vision of the region. The Amazon, of course, has been changed, has been in recent months and years. What you see in the Amazon, just for the recent, I think, National Institute of Space Research, the INPI, just have a research recently, 9% of the country wildfires occur in the Amazon. On top of that, a historical drought has already broke last year record. So, as I told you before, a week ago, there is a study published in Environmental Research Letters that reveals that the water covered in the central Amazonia decreased by 80% in the last 2 months of 2023. And you compare that with the monthly average, the study also predicts even more extreme droughts conditions in years ahead. And this in itself is a picture that shows this imagination that we also thought about the region has been changed. As I mentioned to you before, the air quality in the cities is abysmal. I mean, I said how much the smoke has affecting and harming people's health, agriculture in itself, the economic activities, and also the access to water. But also, we published something recently about how the turtles' nest is being affected by those burn season. So the point that I was trying to say here, the stereotype persists because they serve arguments for its exploitation. Whether framed as a development or even sustainable development, this alternating image of paradise or hell stems from a view that the Amazon as something outside of time, as an exotic place. What we see is not Amazonian, but there is Amazonians in the plural. To preserve and understand the Amazonians, we need to really understand how this environment has unique ways of existence. And most important, it's not a void. It's not an empty place. It's a place where you have humans and no humans living there. Because when you see the burn fire, we just don't connect that. Think about the humans, but don't think about the non-humans that are being affected by. And I think what I was trying to say in this particular essay, what I was trying to call the attention is that it is a paradise to some extent, which is a paradise. And I put that the dubious. Because what you see now, it's an environment that has been destroyed. There has been lack of assistance from the government, protection, care. I think our imaginary about the region has been changed. But I think the change demands that we have a different attitude towards that space, which is not a space of a void, but a space where humans live there and they need to live there the way they want to live and respect their way of living. But when we go there and just destroy the environment, we just change not only the landscape, we change the environment that once was and now is no more. When you talk about this collective imagination, I wanted to highlight that what this imagination or these contemporary narratives of the Amazon reflect the historical dispute between scientific and literary approaches to the region and their attempts to describe or to translate the reality. What I was trying to say in this essay is just to call attention that both approaches reflect this intellectual and political dispute that have been taking place over for more than three centuries in the region, attempting to rationalize this. So what you see in the Amazon, it's a growing dread of intellectual contamination during this period led to a very difficult showdown between science, arts, and dispute in their separate institutionalization of discipline. So this vision that we see when you talk about paradise or talk about hell, behind this, hidden there, it's a dispute of narrative that try to perpetuate a place where those narratives can foster destruction to continue to exploit the region. And it's against that narrative that I'm trying to bring a different kind of approach to look to this and to rethink even what is behind this construction of this canon. When I even address the idea of invention of the Amazon. So I think that there is room to recalibrate our sight. The green hell or the suspect or dubious paradise are at the same time factual and imaginative synthesis of a body of information that brings people's biome ecosystem to a different place. Beyond this Western scientific and literary narratives of the Amazon, I think the imaginary narratives and representations belong to its people. It's important to highlight that. I mean, when you create these narrative tropes, paradise and hell, we are taking that from the narratives and representation imaginary from the people who lives there. And this is a very important point to highlight. Both scientific and literary narratives, they appropriate from those narratives, representation that belongs to its native people in the Amazon, and they take it for them and just utilize them in the way they want. I think we have to reconsider those tropes in those terms. We have to give that back to them in a way that they can reclaim the narrative. The Amazon needs to be imagined and characterized by them who live there. And that go back to this idea of coloniality, of the knowledge. Our knowledge that we have comes from where? From libraries, from books, Western perspective. And they dictate the way you see it, the Amazon. And this is a form of coloniality, of colonialism as well. So I think this tied together, this question with the previous one, which, you know, the Amazon today cannot continue to be seen as in myths, but less metaphorized, I would say, by fables that reinvented the forest according to the Eurocentric imagination. I think what is in stake is our very existence here. So that is the life of all the indigenous communities, people that live there. So whether individuals or group, whether in urban or rural areas, they reimagine or they remain biomes, I would say, they are threatened by economic destruction, exploitation. Yeah, they need to have a different kind of tropes.
So one of the times that the Amazon made major news in the UK, where I'm from, relatively recently, was when the story broke about Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira, probably because Dom was British and he was a journalist, and some of the news organizations he'd written for really adopted the case and been following the developments since. And that has obviously led into kind of raising awareness, not just about the case, but about the wider situation in the Amazon. A lot of people who listen to this podcast are from the USA, and I have no idea if it got the coverage there or not. But I was wondering if you could just explain for people who don't know who Dom and Bruno were and what happened to them.
Well, Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira, like I would say, Zé Cláudio and Maria and Marabá, or even before them, Dorothy Stang, they were killed for defending the forest and its people. They opposed the logic of extractivism and destruction that has been subject the region to the interests of the capitalism, and they paid for it with their own lives. My last film, the open scene of my film, Stepping Softly on the Earth, was filming in the same region where Don and Bruno Pereira were. I was there filming. I received like a kind invitation to leave the area because I was doing something. I was filming a documentary about the illegal fishing, and I was bumping into something that was very complicated and dangerous. So I can relate very much to that, what happened to them. And I dedicate the book to them. So as you know, Bruno Pereira and Don Phillips, they were killed in this Vale do Javari indigenous territory in Atalaia do Norte, which is about, 1,000 maybe kilometers from Manaus. In this particular region, you have about 6,000 indigenous peoples from 7 contact groups, as well as isolated and uncontacted indigenous groups. Bruno, who was an important defender and worked for FUNAI, had been helping the indigenous peoples of the area, the Vale do Javari, to set up surveillance groups to protect their land. What Bruno was doing, trying to give them instrument cameras or geo-referencing tools that he taught them how to locate illegal fishermen, miners, loggers, which made him, of course, a target for those who was exploiting the forest. So I would say that for me personally, it was very difficult and very sad when I heard. We sent a reporter to cover the event for us, for the magazine, which was tragic, as you know. And I think earlier this month, the federal police conclude the investigation into the murder of them and confirmed the involvement of 9 individuals, including the mastermind known as Colombia, He is a leader, actually, of organized crime in the triple frontier between Brazil, Peru, and Colombia, in the Alto Solimões. And throughout the investigation, this guy, you know, this Colombia guy, he used, you know, different names. He self-identified him as a fishman, but the conclusion they have is that he was the one who decided on the death of both Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira. So it's important to highlight that the work that in that time Dom Phillips was doing that incursion there, doing this trip, he was writing a book, and the book is finished by now and should be released next year. The title of the book is How to Save the Amazon, and was finished by friends of his, by Jonathan Watson and many others that took the journey because his wife, Don Phillips' wife, invited a group of his close friends to finish up the book. You have to understand that Bruno was one of the leading experts of uncontacted indigenous peoples, you know. And Don and him partnered together and were in the strip together. And Don brought critical attention to the Amazon struggles in that region as a fine journalist. So both their losses is immense, you know, and cause us, it's going to be a big void for us for as long as we can exist. I think what we have now, the responsibility is to continue their legacy, to fight for what they die for. It's our responsibility, it's our commitment to join and to be their witness and to make sure that their deaths were not in vain. It's important to highlight that in 2022, when the year they were murdered, one in five environmental and land defenders was killed worldwide. A total in that particular year, I think it was 180 or 170 something, were murdered globally. I think this is the, according to Global Witness, I think this is important that we always have that in mind and don't forget why we are here. And that's why I call the Amazon in times of war. We are in war. As I put it in the end of the book, we are not in war, a 20th century war. We are in war for life. And I said here, I quote here Eliane Brum, it's not a war like those of the 20th century, described in history books, and which haunting us to this day. Nor is a war like the one Putin, Russian, has imposed on Ukraine. It is a much longer and more decisive war, one that will extend beyond our lifetimes. When a war breaks out, one cannot choose whether to live through it or not. The war is already underway. We can only choose between fighting or waiting for the flames to engulf us while we pretend that everything's fine. Fighting alongside the people's nature of the Amazon in this war has nothing to do with compassion and goes far beyond ethics. This is a question of survival. We fight for life, end quote. Yes, we fight for life. On the other hand, we have both their lives taken away from us. They were murdered, cut in pieces, and burned. But we continue to stand for them and for the indigenous peoples of the Amazon.
A lot of what we've discussed today, especially that last story, has been about all the challenges facing the Amazon, all the difficulties. But in the book, you also look at how some of its inhabitants are providing examples of how things can be done differently. And you've touched on indigenous knowledges and things like this. And you wrote that the Amazon offers a model which generates peace and alliances between people. And you highlight those indigenous models of stewardship. So what sources of hope do you see for the future?
Well, I think our hopes are in the indigenous peoples in the Amazon. I think also about this other possibles. Through such diverse connections, it's an interdisciplinary level of knowledge and know-how that the indigenous can give to us, that recalibrate all our way of being in this planet. not only our way of seeing, but being. The other possibles, it's possible because the indigenous can enable us. The indigenous thinking provide us with recalibrating us. It reconfigures our view of a way of thinking, a way of feeling. So for instance, when you think of an example of, in my film, for instance, there is a tribal chief, Katia, Akak and Kateje. I think of the resistance of a woman who, at the age of 9, was banished together with her brothers from their own home, her own land, her own culture, her own ancestry. So this woman who lost everything, including her own name, later on, this woman, he is still fighting today. And she fights to try to reclaim the narrative, but she fights in the midst of those situations with joy. If I learn one thing, Max, with the indigenous communities, I learned that resistance, it's important. But what I learned from them is the joy is a form of resistance. That for me is powerful because they have been fighting for more than 500 years, whatever time you can put in a timeline. But you talk to them, they have joy. Even when their life, their territory is contaminated, their land is taking over, the forest being destroyed, I always ask myself, what have the indigenous people resisted harassment of over 500 years? Why have they continued to struggle for survival? I do believe that that is the most important component. For them, joy is a form of resistance. And what I try to do in my work and in my films is just to highlight these other possibles that the indigenous peoples have in their own daily lives, in their struggle for life. The indigenous people have taught me and show me in their struggles, not only those of the present, they are battling for life. It's a fight that they teach me different ways to perceive and to see. And I could mention several examples of how the indigenous community has been teaching me how to find this balance, provide a model, as you said, for peace and alliance among people. One example of this is, for instance, I love it, is when Emmanuel Cochi said, he talks about point of life instead of point of view. For me, what I learned from this experience is that the indigenous see the river as a point of life. Everything functions towards that river. Everybody goes to that river. Everybody have their food from that river. And that's not a point of view. It's a point of life. And that life is spread towards the whole community because they have one center there. I think it's so beautiful to see this image as a way that connects the community and themselves. For instance, the Amazon, it's not an empty space, as I said in the beginning. Traditional communities in the Amazon, including Quilombolas, of course, the riparian population there, they have been living there for centuries. And they have been not only adapted to the region, their lifestyle are deeply intertwined with the forest, often escape the logic of this accumulation that you see today. So they live with that, what they need, without extracting more than the forest can provide. The territories are part of their own identity. And the defender of the Amazon has protected their own bodies. So I think in my last film, what we saw, it was Kernaki says, using these metaphors or images. I like Kernaki when he always speaks to images. And he said in this that we are in a party and you have a lot of cake here, but there is one moment that the cake will be, over. And the cake, they take a word cake and became like a neologism. But what he's trying to say is that he tried to call our attention how we related to those resources and how the indigenous communities does relate it to that sources, you know? And I think there is a distinction way of thinking right there. Yes, I do believe that if you go back to the original question about colonialism, what I think colonialism did not just steal land, it rewrote the story of nature. It taught us to see the earth as something to dominate, not something to belong to. When you belong to somewhere, when you connect to somewhere, that changed everything. So the fight for decolonization is the fight to unlearn this lie and rebuild something, rebuild our relationship with the planet. And that's what the indigenous communities provide us, this step, an alliance that we reconnect ourselves. I see hope. But hope itself, it's not enough. We need to act. We need action. And I wrote a recent piece when I described the indigenous communities, they cannot solve the problem of the planet by themselves. They need us. We need to join forces with them. I think the hope comes when you act together. We're going to have ahead of us a 2025 with a new administration in the White House that will do everything in their power to dismantle environmental policies. And we will advance this narrative of destruction, you know, predatory destruction in the region, demanding for more raw material, more exploitation. And I think what the indigenous communities can offer us is a way, you know, to go beyond that, to pass that mentality. We need to go back to that. We need to go back to understand what we have today, what the indigenous peoples offer us today. It's the most modern knowledge we can get, because they have spent 500 years, whatever time you can put in the timeline, I'm repeating that again, learning, interacting with the forest, nature, the biome. And what you have as a result is the pristine, prime knowledge of how to understand forests, how to understand nature, how to relate with that. That should set us apart from everything else. And that should be, I mean, where you should look at it, to value their knowledge, to value what they have to offer, because what they bring to us, it's huge amount of history and knowledge that really can set us in a different path moving forward. That's the point that I think I wanted to highlight. I finished this with this thought by Ayuto Krenaki, because I think it's very important when he said the future is ancestral. And it's a powerful word which gives us hope. The future is ancestral because it's not in the future, but it's in the past. It's the ancestrality. And that is super important, because thinking about the Amazon through its people implies reconfiguring our view and our perception. Also recognize that we are living in a biocultural amnesia. To get away from this biocultural amnesia, we need this ancestralism, this ancestrality. That is, we need to reconnect to life, to the points of life, as Emmanuel Kot is saying, not point of views. And we need to reconnect to life and to the ancestral memory. It's mean looking at the Amazon through the indigenous thinking and the ancestral knowledge. We need to leave behind the equivocal arrogance of civilization that's destroying us in the name of so-called progress.
It's a lot to think about. Thank you for that. Thank you for coming on and sharing all your knowledge. The book's called The Amazon in Times of War. It's out now, and it's published by Practical Action Publishing and the Latin American Bureau. So there's plenty more in there, including a selection of photos, which are really good, really capture the feeling of the Amazon. So if you're interested in learning more, it's out now. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Max.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.